On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we talk about data centers and how they're recycling their hardware. Plus, we talk about neurodiversity in the workplace. And Curtis, Heather, and I talk with Richard Sirota from Pivotal about DevOps and serverless app solutions. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 333, recorded March 15th, 2019, serverless with Pivotal Cloud Foundry. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by LastPass. Ensure safer workplace password sharing with LastPass, the number one most preferred password manager. Visit LastPass.com/twit to learn more. And by LinkedIn Talent Solutions. Find the right people for your business this year at LinkedIn.com/this week and get $50 off your first job post. Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host, Louis Moreski, your guide through this big world of the enterprise. But I definitely can't guide you by myself. I need a little help from some of the top enterprise tech professionals in the industry, starting with our world traveler and enterprise expert, our very own Ms. Heather Mo Williams, Senior Product Solutions Architect at Rutgers Network. Welcome back, Mo.
Hey, thanks for having me back. How are you guys doing?
I'm doing fantastic. Now, were you able to get a little R&R over the last couple of weeks? I know you've been traveling a lot and doing a lot of work.
I'm a grad student, so I have, there's R&R is involved with learning the AP system, so no.
Well, I definitely need some R&R in the coming weeks because spring is coming. But speaking of people who may need some R&R as well, we have our very busy Mr. Curtis Franklin, senior editor at Dark Reading. Curtis, welcome back.
It is great to be back, Lou. I was out in San Francisco at RSA last week, and when I came back to Florida, I left my lungs in San Francisco. So they, I think, are finally catching up to me here, and it's a good thing. So feeling better, feeling much warmer, and feeling very happy to be here on Twyatt.
We always seem to leave something in San Francisco, but we may need to actually have you come back on and do a little bit of some RSA comp as well, because we want to get some of your views on that as well.
Always happy to do it.
Fantastic. Well, folks, we have a great show for you today. We're going to talk a little bit about data centers and how they're recycling hardware. Plus, we have a great guest from Pivotal to talk about DevOps server applications and serverless applications and some of the solutions that are available there. Plus, we're going to talk a little bit about how they can be applied. But before we do, let's go into all that goodness. Before we actually go into all that goodness, let's go ahead and jump into this week's blips. Well, we're all aware that all the tech giants out there, and what do you think? Is there enough competition for those tech giants? Well, according to a report done as part of the government review of giant sectors, the report is talking about, is there really enough competition for them? Well, led by Professor Jason Furman, a Harvard professor and former chief economic advisor of the past administrations, confirmed that tech giants like Facebook, Amazon, Google, Apple, and Microsoft do not face enough competition. While the review was commissioned by Chancellor Philip Hammond last year and makes recommendations on changes to the competition and pro-competition policies to ensure the UK's digital standing. Now, in past episodes, we've talked about cloud service lock-in. Well, the report points out that the control over personal data by tech giants is one of the main causes preventing competition and ultimately innovation. Now, there are several interesting points in the report, but one key point raised in the report is that the government should ensure that authorities responsible for enforcing competition and consumer law, such as the Competition and Markets Authority, CMA, have more powers to carry out their functions in the digital economy. Now, the Furman review also highlights the introduction of measures to promote greater data mobility, as well as another key area where its change is required. So giving people more control over their own information to allow them to change platforms more easily. That's the whole server lock-in concept. Now, it also points out the need for greater data openness, so creating a requirement for larger companies to share data sets, is another point raised in the main recommendations as a pro-competition tool, where the government would work in with the industry towards setting and managing common data standards. Now, as with all reports like these, they point out interesting data and possible interesting solutions, but it takes more than this to force large players to change. Now, feel free to take a look at the report yourself and see where you too can help in this movement.
Well, a proof of concept tracking system has found rats worldwide. Using a combination of Shodan scans and data from partners, Recorded Future has found nearly 500 malware controllers for 14 different families of remote access Trojans, as well as the corporate networks they've infected. Using only network scans and metadata collected between December 2nd, 2018 and January 8th of this year, Recorded Future uncovered 481 command and control, or C2, servers used by attackers to manage computer systems compromised by 14 different families of those remote access Trojans, or rats. In the report, which focused on three particular Trojans, Emotet, Extreme Rat, and Zero Access, the company found nearly 20 C2 servers managing Emotet infections, more than 30 managing Zero Access infections, and nearly 70 managing Extreme Rat infections. The detected servers only comprise a fraction of the total remote access threat on the internet because the technique can't find every server. But what it did find shows that this is a very serious and widespread problem. Once attackers have compromised a single system inside a network, they have a beachhead from which they can steal data, install additional functionality, or infect other systems through lateral movement. Now, as part of the report, Recorded Future released the IP addresses of the C2 servers and indicators of compromise for the rats. The company recommended that firms look for communications to those IP addresses in their logs, and I'll recommend that you head over to Recorded Future and check out the report and all the details.
Target market, script kiddies. There's a new article published by Dark Reading this week that documents a new trend in malware that manages to be both scary and annoying. Hackers, of course, excel at making something work in a way that differs from the original intention. So it's no surprise that they've begun using marketing to their advantage. The article details how different malware authors, from the basic to the more sophisticated code writers, are using advanced marketing techniques to get their products into the hands of bad actors, who, in growing numbers, do not need to be all that knowledgeable. Malware is bought and sold in various online forums, and the new trend has it being packaged with marketing material that includes modular formatting and video instructions for how to install and use it. This makes the entry-level point for the potential new bad actors quite low. All of the malware described in the article targets point-of-sale systems, which means a new headache for security pros in retail and hospitality. And although malware like this is marketed globally, the victims are disproportionately based in the U.S. because the U.S. lags behind the rest of the world and is still issuing credit cards with magnetic strips. Additionally, many U.S. stores have continued to delay moving to chip readers. POS systems, and in this case the acronym POS can mean whatever you want it to mean, that require cards to be swiped are vulnerable, and the younger cyber criminals are able to access ready-made kits that come complete with video or photo instructions and access to support through direct messaging. It all brings new meaning to let the buyer beware.
Well, DARPA is back again. Just to refresh you, they are the folks that brought us what eventually turned into the internet and many of our modern day technology advances. Last week, we talked about how DARPA was tackling challenges and advances around AI. Well, this week, they're all about tackling one of the modern day marvels of politics, secure voting systems, and doing it as open source. Now, you say, open source? Really? Well, here's the interesting part. It will be developed with new secure open source hardware as well to ensure numerous layers of security and protection from certain kinds of hacking. Now, the first of its kind system will be designed by an Oregon-based firm called Galwa, a longtime government contractor with experience in designing secure and verifiable systems. As part of the initiative and plan, DARPA and Galwa will publish open source code on the software online and bring prototypes of the system to DEF CON, Voting Village, this this summer, next, and next summer, so that the hackers and researchers will also be able to freely examine the system themselves and conduct penetration tests to gauge their security. Now, the system's design won't be available for sale, but the prototypes created will be available for existing voting machine vendors or others to freely adopt and customize without costly licensing fees or the other millions of dollars it would take to research and develop such a system from scratch. Now, Galwa would design two basic voting machine types. The first will be a ballot marketing device that uses a touchscreen for voters to make their selections. The system won't tabulate votes. Instead, it will be print out the paper ballots marked with the voters' choices so the voters can review them before depositing them into an optical scan machine that tabulates the votes. Galwa will bring this system to DEF CON this year as well. And although it may not be in time for some of the near future elections, long term, you might just find that voting can be secure and provide the value we all knew it could bring.
Well, CIOs have made headway toward a more strategic position in the organization, but they're still finding these challenging speed bumps on the road to digital. You know, these days, CIOs and IT organizations have shifted to contributing strategic value to the technology within the company, even if the business itself is sometimes slow to recognize that contribution. The shift is evident in a new CIO survey and report from Grant Thornton, a tax, audit, and advisory services firm. The survey showed that 81% of CIOs say their IT organizations drive innovation or modernization programs, and 79% have a voice in business or agency strategy and strategic initiatives. As we go down the report, 65% proactively identify and remove obstacles to improving the delivery of projects and services, and 53% drive stabilization of operations. Now, these results reveal in total a much bigger focus on strategy. According to Grant Thornton, today's CIOs understand that the role of the IT organization is more than a back office cost center responsible for keeping systems running and reporting runtimes. IT organizations are a critical component of developing and executing business strategy. Now, one of the places the report notes that CIOs are falling short is in communicating the value of IT in a way that their business partners understand. That communication is clearly something that CIOs know they need to improve, and developing the skill can help with IT's strategic shift. The survey report concludes that the CIO role continues to evolve, and there are four leadership characteristics that each of these IT leaders must cultivate. The four are to be strategists, communicators, business relationship managers, and change managers or instigators.
Hacker-in-chief, anyone? A Reuters article filed this afternoon is a precursor to a book being released this June, titled Cult of the Dead Cow, How the Original Hacking Supergroup Might Just Save the World. Normally, this announcement would sound like a great reason for us to announce the formation of the Twiat Book Club. But this book offers more than insight into a famous hacktivist group. It also acknowledges that among the membership of the Lubbock-based organization is Beto O'Rourke, who just announced his candidacy for U.S. president. The Cult of the Dead Cow, which was jokingly named after an abandoned Texas slaughterhouse, is known for inventing the word hacktivism to describe human rights-driven security work. The article highlights characteristics that hackers around the world share. O'Rourke was a misfit Texas teen in the 1980s when he got interested in bulletin board systems, which were a way of finding a community. He soon created his own board, Taco Land, and began meeting others who shared interests in hunting for video games that had been cracked or stripped from digital rights protection so that they could be played for free. O'Rourke credits the Cult of the Dead Cow with developing his thinking in a number of ways, including his fight to restore net neutrality, the principle which prevented internet providers from favoring some contents over others. As Beto said in an interview, there's just this profound value in being able to be apart from the system and then look at it critically while having fun while you're doing it. I think of the Cult of the Dead Cow as a great example of that.
Now, we all know Google's known for collecting a little bit of location data or two. Well, so do authorities, and they have been knocking at Google's door for several years with warrants to tap into the company's extensive stores of cell phone location data. Now, dubbed reverse location search warrants, these legal mandates allow law enforcement to sweep up the coordinates and movements of every cell phone in a broad area. Now, the police can then check to see if any of the phones came close to the crime scene they're looking for. In doing so, however, the police can end up not only fishing for suspects, but also gathering location data of potentially hundreds or thousands of innocent people as well. Now, what are some of the examples of law enforcement using such an approach? Well, the Raleigh Police Department sought reverse location data in 2017 for investigations into murder, sexual battery, and suspect arson. Now, police were able to obtain data for crimes that occurred as far back as 2015. Only one of the cases has resulted in an arrest. Now, in their warrants, police have instructed Google to keep their data requests secret for up to 3 months. Now, the department reportedly got the idea to reuse reverse location searches after learning that the State Bureau of Investigation in Orange County, California, had also employed the technique. There's also an example in Minnesota, police departments having to obtain at least 22 reverse location search warrants since August. According to the report by Minnesota Public Radio, the warrants have at times sought location data in a 33-hour window, potentially giving officers information of tens of thousands of people. Now, the warrants have sought to gather information data in crimes ranging from home invasions to theft of $650 worth of tires. Now, the FBI is also known to be collecting this data as well. And now, well, in the modern day world of data privacy, folks, it might be time for you to jump on your phone and start opting out of data collection. We need to keep investigators on their toes. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, we have the bites. But first, we have to thank a really great sponsor of this week, Enterprise Tech, and that's LastPass. Now, I don't have to tell you, because you might already know here, but people have all their favorite tools, and that, you know, those tools tend to save you time and money. And in my case, this is LastPass. Now, who loves LastPass? I definitely do, and I'm going to take a guess that you do too, because I use LastPass so often, I don't know if I'm actually using it anymore. Think about it. You have a username and password for every site you go to, every site, especially the ones you are actually most important to you, every financial site, business site, social network, email, you name it. For me, I have 5 different banks, so I'm supposed to have different username and passwords for every site and every bank. Now, it comes in, it basically is impossible to remember and manage, and you don't want to write those passwords on a sticky note on your desk because people can find them. You don't want to put them in your email because that's just plain text where people can find them. Now, that's where LastPass comes in and saves us all. LastPass automatically remembers and fills your passwords anytime, anywhere, whether you're on your computer or your mobile device. All you have to do is remember your master password, and LastPass remembers the rest. Now, I got hooked when I started using it on my desktop, but it also is pretty useful, quite useful on all of my devices as well. Every one of them, I use them in my browser and in browser add-ins, where they also support Chrome, Edge, Firefox, Opera, and more. Plus, it works great on Android and iOS devices. Now, what adds to the peace of mind here is that your data is encrypted and decrypted at the device level. This means that data is stored in a vault, and it's kept secret even from LastPass. Now, I do remember the day I was at work and my family needed to get a password for the bank account to make a payment. Did I remember that? No, of course I did not. So all I had to do is visit LastPass Vault, use my one and only master password, and bam, I could have that password. I gave it to them. They were able to save time and money and pay that bill. Which is, you know, time is money for people. Now, I've been talking about my personal account here, but they also have LastPass families for the entire family, and LastPass works amazing for enterprise. Now, enterprise is always battling people trying to breach their networks, and check out this piece of data. 81% of breaches are caused by weak or reused passwords. That's crazy. LastPass makes it easy to use unique random passwords that your employees don't have to remember right now down. Now, every employee has their own secure vault for managing and accessing passwords. Plus, in large organizations, people have to share passwords, right? Because you have services that are common, and that's a hard thing to do securely. Now, passing a sticky note could actually be the last straw to your environment. Well, LastPass makes it easy for your organization to share those passwords, plus it allows for complete customization around access. You can set master password requirements, restrict access, enable password resets, and more. Another big thing, multi-factor auth. They have an authenticator. It blocks attackers even more so. Plus, this is great for IT admins. They have Active Directory integration. That means you really only have to remember one password. That's your AD credentials, and you still get access to your password vault. Now, for me, this just makes it so I don't have to really remember anything but that AD password. Now, also with LastPass Summarize, you configure over 100 policies, access security ports, and create shared folders. You can also secure tons of stuff, including database logins, SSH keys, software licensing, and more. From easy onboarding to password autofill, LastPass makes it easy for your business to take control of their passwords, and it targets reducing the threat of a breach. I love this tool. I use this tool. I will continue to use this tool. Protect yourself and your business with LastPass, the number one most preferred password manager trusted by over 43,000 businesses. Join over 13.5 million people and find the best password solution for your team at LastPass.com/twit. That's LastPass.com/twit. And we thank LastPass for their support in This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, let's go ahead and jump into the blips. Now, where do all the poor hard drives go once they're thrown out from data centers or workstations alike? Well, do they have a final resting place? Well, every year, there's literally roughly 20 million hard drives that are retired from data centers. Now, where do those things go? What happens to them? Well, even though they may become electronic waste, those previously spinning accessories could contain reusable elements. Now, since this, there's actually a report that came out back in 2010 that says, hey, there's rare earth elements that are on, they're actually having becoming more rare. And they have to find ways to mitigate that supply risk. Now, drives in some cloud provider data centers are replaced every 2 to 3 years. Now, those drives could be erased and reused, but most end up being shredded and sold for scrap metal, aluminum, or steel. Now, in Tennessee, the leftover waste slag from metal recovery facilities, which contains rare earth elements, including gold, platinum, and sometimes are used for paving roads. But could they have other uses? Could they be reused, maybe? Now, the organization wants to find new ways to breathe new life into hard drives and put them back into circulation. One approach by researchers is to extract the magnetic material from the mix and turn it back into oxide powder, the starting material for magnets, and actually reuse it to reprocess and generate magnet blocks. Now, another strategy is to remove the valuable magnets whole. With Google's 6 drives that they actually gave away recently, the entire magnet assemblies were moved manually into a clean room. The magnet assemblies were then passed on to Seagate, where they were placed into new drives. Now, Google has since verified the drives are functional. This is interesting because this means that they're going to start reusing just the magnetic components of this. Now, first, I want to throw this over to Heather first, because you've worked with a lot of industries and organizations that have large data centers. Are you seeing a lot of this kind of recycling, updates of the hard drives that often?
Actually, this is really interesting because according to the EC Council, the only appropriate way to recycle is to kill it with fire. And somebody in our chat group mentioned the use of a blowtorch. So I'm actually really heartened that this could start to be more of a trend. I have some security concerns. But if they're reducing it to oxide powder, I would say that I'm fairly confident that my privacy has not been invaded at that point. And I do hope that that we continue to go green in this way.
Yeah, I think that's interesting because there are different ways they're actually doing this, right? They're either taking the magnets, they're reusing them, they're putting them in new drives and where there's new platters and so on. But there are instances where they're just recycling the drive. They're erasing the data. They're making sure it's still working. They maybe even replace the magnet, so on and so forth, and then they recycle the drive. So, Curtis, I want to throw this over to you. I'm big on recycling, but, you know, is this process going to hold water? Is it like Heather said, you know, is this secure? Is this the best way to do this?
Well, yeah, the problem comes if you're trying to recycle, each of our recycling processes tends to be designed to reprocess one thing. So, for example, when you're shredding it and recycling it for aluminum, you have a process that's optimized for extracting the aluminum from the mix and everything else, all those rare earth elements and everything else. When they talk about slag, basically what's happening is that it floats to the surface and this sort of foamy mixture gets skimmed off and then used to pave roads or do other things. So if we are going to reuse other parts, other materials, then we'll need a system for doing that. That means there has to be enough of those rare earth minerals to make it worthwhile to extract. So there's a whole long chain of economic considerations that have to be put into place. Now, as for reusing the drives whole, as Mo said, you get into some real questions about security. I mean, are we going to completely write the platters with ones, rewrite them with zeros, and do that 20 or 30 times? Because I think that's the sort of thing that it would take to really bury any previous information unless you really wanted to just, you know, go in, take a magnetic field and gauss the living daylights out of them. I think it's a wonderful thing. And I've seen a lot of interesting uses for the different parts. For example, I have a buddy who takes those extra strong rare earth magnets and finds that they are really fine things for holding tarps in place in the bed of his pickup truck. That kind of use is great. For these others, for the very largest organizations in terms of their use of servers, they, you know, the Googles, the Amazons, and some of the big cloud providers of the world, it might be worthwhile. Other than that, I would need to see some of the spreadsheets on it to know whether it's going to make economic sense.
Right, that makes sense. I think that was my next question. I think, Heather, you work with a lot of organizations. Do you see a lot of turnaround, like a lot of people trying to a lot of data centers trying to recycle their drives? Could it be profitable? Could it be actually generate more profit than just scrapping and shredding?
If they can find a way to scale it, then yeah, I think that there is going to be a way. I know that these days companies are just looking for any way to save a penny. So if they can regain one penny while they're going out and spending a gazillion on their next new set of servers, then I can see if you've got an enterprise that can come in and make this scale. However, I would like to throw one other thing. If it were you and you were going to be throwing your hard drives to Bubba Joe, who's making a profit off of this, what kind of insurance program would they have to have in place to cover themselves in case of some kind of a security breach? Because I could see this being, I could see this becoming a massive endeavor on some entrepreneurial hackers' site.
Right. Good food for thought. Well, first I want to go ahead and move on because we have a really good, Curtis has a really good story here about neurodiversity in the tech world. So Curtis, I'll kind of throw it over to you.
Yeah, it's interesting. When most of us talk about diversity in the IT workforce, we talk for some of the very needed advances in diversity that are being made in terms of gender representation, representation of people of various racial and ethnic backgrounds, as well as LGBTQ diversity. But there are other lines of diversity that we need to think about. And one of my colleagues over at Dark Reading did a story titled Autism, Cybercrime and Security Skill Struggle. And the fact is that people in different places along the spectrum that is autism often possess traits that could help them succeed in cybersecurity. That is, if they aren't tempted into cybercrime first. And, it's interesting. There are many cyber criminals who aren't diagnosed with autism until they enter the criminal justice system, when to a certain extent it's a little late. The same traits that led them toward cybercrime could very easily help them fight it. Now, Rebecca Lettingham, vice president of cybersecurity at MasterCard, spotted the trend earlier in her career as a cyber agent for the UK's National Crime Agency, when she pointed out that these weren't the same sort of criminals that she was seeing when she had dealt with drugs and sex crimes. Their social behavior was different than what she had seen in other criminals. Now, often this social behavior isn't diagnosed as being on the autism spectrum during criminal justice proceedings. It's only later in her career, when she was working for Interpol, that she realized the issue was broader. Her work with global agencies revealed that outside of cybercrime, no other offense came with a foundational condition. In other words, there was no other set of crimes where you could draw the same very direct line between an existing neurological condition and cybercrime. So the question becomes, why do they do it? Well, often people with autism are quite good with math and science because those are very logic and syntax driven, as is IT. There typically and frequently is one way to do things right. And that one-way rule-guided environment is something that many people who are on the autism spectrum find comforting and comfortable. In addition, many people with autism are pattern thinkers, and many of them are hyperlexic, which is a term for those who are intensely interested in letters and numbers and who possess an advanced reading ability. For them, it would be very easy to go between, say, English and code because they understand each with equal ease. So why turn to cybercrime? Well, we have left many of our legitimate businesses sort of on the outskirts of those who are on the autism spectrum. People in cybercrime have been much more welcoming. Take social anxiety. If you've been in any kind of business, you know how important the after-work mixer, the casual conversation in the hall, all of that is. Whereas in cybercrime, it's often a very disparate, widely geographically dispersed network of individuals who never have to have that kind of interaction. Now, college is another example. You have many companies that absolutely positively require a college degree before you can make it through the HR weeding process to get a job. Cybercrime tends not to have that same sort of weeding process. And people with autism are often overwhelmed by college physical classes. They can have poor grades because of that and have difficulty making it through. On the internet, they can be who they want to be. So the general thrust is that people are beginning to be aware that organizations could benefit by welcoming employees with autism. Unfortunately, a lot of those companies don't know how. They tend to interview one-to-one rather poorly, struggle with the behavioral-related questions, those kind of interesting questions that Google became famous for. Instead, questions need to be specific, literal, direct, and they should have a deadline. The more you spell things out, Meyer said, the easier it is. And it can help to approach the hiring process in a project-oriented way. If you've got somebody coming in, give them a project and evaluate how they do on it and hire them based upon the output of the project. Now, she pointed to Microsoft as a company, as an example of a company with a program that is designed for workers with autism. And as a result, they have one of the more comprehensive hiring programs where neuro differences are concerned. So I'm going to turn to my co-host now and ask you, Lou, I'll start with you. Have you ever worked with or managed someone that you knew was on the spectrum?
So I haven't actually worked with somebody directly, but I've knew people on other teams that that have worked with people that are, you know, of this, of neurodiversity. And I can tell you that, you know, I've been in design meetings and architectural meetings where there's many like-minded individuals in these meetings, and problem solving is sometimes hard. I mean, you try to solve the problem all the same way and it's never going to be solved. But as soon as you get somebody in there can completely think differently, think at a different level, it tends to change how things are solved. And I definitely have seen that in the past. And that's one of the reasons Microsoft has these diversity programs, is to start bringing in that level of diversity into the, you know, the modern day challenges that we have today, especially in technology. And when you get that different way of thinking and you integrate it into the mix, into the recipe of problem solving, you find that you can literally solve challenges in completely different ways and sometimes easier ways. And so I can honestly say, I've seen this happen. Now, I personally haven't had anybody on my team that's been like that, but I can definitely say I would have no problem hiring somebody like that, because we have tons of challenges that we're constantly digging at day in, day in, day out. that we could definitely use somebody thinking differently on it. So I can definitely see this as an advantage going forward in future hiring.
Well, Mo, I want to come to you because one of the questions that I have for you, I mean, you're down there in Texas where people tend to be straight shooters and all that. So do you see this as being one of those sort of social issues that glosses things over and make people feel good? Or do you see some real advantages that can come to an organization if they go to the trouble to be more welcoming to those who are in, as Steve Silberman would say, different neuro tribes?
Well, look, we're all veterans of the tech world, so let's not kid ourselves. And Lou, I'm gonna have you go look in the mirror for a second, because if you haven't worked with someone who's on the spectrum, then it might be you in the group, because I haven't worked with a group yet that didn't have at least one person who you was classically at least on the spectrum for autism. Ours is an industry that it's just a good fit. But back to your question that was more about diversity, I think, I guess I almost think of this as a no-brainer, because it's not just that you can solve problems in maybe a better way, a different way, a more efficient way. It's that when you have people with different backgrounds, different perspectives, different ways of approaching things, you'll find that you identify problems that you didn't even know about or would not have even seen. So it's not just that you're answering them, it's that you're and as we all know, identifying the problem first is it's half of the battle. And so I think that this has been shown in all kinds of groups. Companies have seen this as they brought in people from different ethnic backgrounds or different genders and different walks of life. They see this. And there was a great article recently about the Air Force repurposing their aircraft mechanics, because they share, not that they're on the spectrum, but they do share the same methodical checklist approach to problem solving. That aircraft doesn't roll out of the hangar until absolutely everything on the list was done and done in order. And so if you're doing threat hunting, or if you're trying to identify security breaches, this is a skill set or a trait or a habit, a work habit that is definitely an advantage.
You know, I absolutely agree that need for looking at problems from different vantage points is something that we have in the industry and in others. And Mo, I agree with you. Being on the spectrum is kind of like the experience I had back in the, I guess, early 90s when we first started talking about adults with ADHD. And I saw the list of, you know, if you have three of these qualities, you may suffer with ADHD. I looked at the list and it described everyone I knew in the computer industry. Not just most of the people, I mean, everyone I knew. And there are elements of being on the spectrum that are the same. And I don't want to in any way make light of this. It's just we are advancing in our understanding of these neurological differences, what they mean, and how many people are different in the way their brains are put together. I have a good friend that I met the last time I was in graduate school. We still chat on one of the social networks regularly, even though he is on the other side of the world. And there's an author that I would recommend. His name's Steve Silberman, and he wrote a book called Neurotribes about this issue. I think I may have Chiebert get in touch with him, see if maybe we can get him on at some point. I think this would be a fascinating major issue to talk about on the show, because we know that despite everything else in cybersecurity, in cloud development, in all sorts of areas, we are struggling as an industry to find enough qualified people to do the work that there is to be done. And so being more broad in the way we hire people, being more creative in the ways we come up with to evaluate their skills and bring them on board, the better I believe it is for the entire industry. Well, that's the bite and my soapbox all rolled into one. And since I think we've finished both, Lou, I'll turn it back over to you.
Thank you, Curtis. Appreciate it. Well, folks, that does it for the Bipes. We're going to jump into our guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. But first, before we do that, we have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's LinkedIn Talent Solutions. All right, where are all the professionals today? You know, they're on LinkedIn. If you're actually hiring for your small business, you naturally want to find the best person for the job. And odds are that person is on LinkedIn. It's the world's largest professional network. 70% of the U.S. workforce is on LinkedIn. Some of the biggest names in the industry post content on there every day. I post there. I job jobs, interests, technology, everything. My professional network wouldn't be what it is today without LinkedIn. Now, that goes to show you that LinkedIn can really help your business. Post your job where people can go every day to make connections, grow in their career, and discover that job an opportunity. Now, you have used other sites, but they just don't feel right. They're clunky, plus their responses to your jobs are not from the right people. Now, what I've seen from job postings on LinkedIn is that LinkedIn jobs are matched based on skills and background, but they add to the secret sauce recipe by also matching based off of interests, activities, and passions as well. Impressive, most impressive. Now, what does that mean for your business? Well, it means that LinkedIn will match you quickly with a group of the most relevant, qualified candidates in the job you're looking for. Now, in that way, you can actually focus on the candidates you want to spend time talking to and make a quality hire you're actually excited about. Now, if you think about it, there are 500 million pros on LinkedIn every day, and LinkedIn is the best way to get your job opportunity in front of the right people. Why else would customers rate LinkedIn jobs number one in delivering quality hires? It's because it just works. It gives you the tools to target your next generation workforce with laser precision. Now, I bet you wouldn't be surprised if I told you a new hire is made every 8 seconds using LinkedIn. Now, I've used them in the past. It's amazing how fast you can literally scale your talent acquisition when you're using LinkedIn. Post a job today at linkedin.com/thisweek and get $50 off your first job post. That's linkedin.com/thisweek to get $50 off your first job post. linkedin.com/thisweek. And we thank LinkedIn for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's that time of the show. We get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot and do some serious knowledge dropping. It is today with from Richard Sirota, VP of Product Marketing from Pivotal. Welcome to the show, Richard.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Now, our folks at home, they love to hear origin stories and people's journey through tech. Can you maybe take us through your journey and how you started in tech and how you are today, where you are today?
Yeah, sure. I don't like taking the same job twice. So after starting in consulting with Accenture and doing the startup at Avid, got into Microsoft as a solution architect and then a biotech company as a architect there, and then product management, VP of product management, and I try my hand at marketing, which is why I'm at Pivotal today.
Fantastic, fantastic. Now, Pivotal is doing some pretty amazing things, especially with serverless technology. They're doing things with DevOps. They're doing lots of things to help organizations become more fluid in their processes and their workflows. Today, we want to focus a little bit more on FAS services. Now, these are functions as a service and serverless. Can you maybe take us through? Now, we've talked about this in the past, but obviously, service is constantly changing. There's lots more offerings. There's lots more applications for it. Can maybe take us through serverless and what it is today and how it's being implemented?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, interesting, serverless was equated with function as a service for a long time, right? That's really the compute portion of serverless. That the goal of serverless is let's write less code and let's only be responsible for the things that are actually my app. I don't want to patch operating systems. I don't want to stand up firewall rules. I don't want to deal with any of that stuff. I would like to just ship my application, and that's the only thing I'm responsible for. So if I don't have to patch any layer, then I'm probably running on a serverless platform. So the goal is write less code, ship software faster. So these platforms have been good at that. So you have things like Amazon Lambda and Azure Functions and Google Cloud Functions and a lot of these cool compute layers. And then you have things around the data services. You have things like Twilio for communication. You have all these managed services. So if I do serverless right, what I think I'm doing is I'm taking all these managed services for things like identity and data storage and notification. And then I'm using things like a FAS to maybe do the glue code. It takes data from this service and calls things here and does little bits to connect it. And it'll keep me from just writing a ton of code that does those things those managed services do. So I'm shipping software faster by stitching together managed services that require virtually no operations on my part.
Right. And I think that's interesting you said that, because you're right. I think that the sometimes FASs are kind of the entry point to this long workflow and data flow, right? And I think that especially, like, I've seen, actually watched some of your talks before the show, and I've seen you kind of point out some architectures, you know, using, you know, in fact, I watched the Azure one around using Event Hub and how the data came in through there, and then it went through some other services and then finally got Cosmos DBs and vice versa. And there was this big long architecture, and you talked about kind of how the flow of data. Now that becomes a lot more complex. So even though, you know, we're talking, hey, we can, this could be event driven, this could be the entry point is FAS. How can organizations take care of their such large architectures? What can they do to make it easier for them to go through that?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, one thing I like to joke is this is the first kind of cloud architecture that doesn't let you cheat. Meaning, when I went from maybe an app running on a physical machine to a virtual machine, I could just pick that thing up and move it, right? I didn't have to change anything. Even arguably going from a virtual machine app running there, a Java app, a .NET app, whatever, to a PaaS, to a container runtime, again, maybe zero changes. But I would argue there's nothing sitting in the enterprise today that just runs in a FAS or runs in serverless. This is the first one making you stop and think, what is the architecture for this thing? Am I taking advantage of all the scalability, all that stuff? But to your point, there gets to be different architectural complexity. There's not just that two servers I go to when something breaks. Right now, all of a sudden, I'm stitching together a timeline of a bunch of functions that lived for half a second, spread all over the place. I can't recreate what happened yesterday. It's just a more dynamic, fluid architecture. So I have to pay more attention to audit trails. I have to think about how I monitor. I have to think about that data flow up front, because I might have four different functions spinning up from the data. Now I have to trace that back. So I think for a lot of companies, just starting to think about what is the supporting machinery around functions. It's not just throwing a bunch of code that used to be in an application into three dozen functions and calling it a day. I have to think of architecture day to life stuff.
Right. Now, you kind of alluded to this a little bit. What are kind of the modern day application infrastructures that people are moving more towards serverless? Do you have some examples?
Yeah, as you mentioned earlier, a lot of this is around the data processing. You see, how do I take data in? How do I think about some more web APIs? How do I think about these sort of bursty APIs where I want to just look up a quick piece of data and return something back? I saw something today from a company that looked at how used functions to take data in, use a function to quick just parse it and stick it into a non-relational database. So just different architectures, usually for processing data. Some of the serverless advocates like to think that anything greenfield should be serverless. I'm not that crazy yet. I don't think we're at that point where everything can run there. But there is a sort of model where I can do request response applications. I can do messaging event-driven architectures. I can do data processing pipelines. All kinds of different modern apps that do still make a lot of sense there. I would suspect that in a few years, this will become a dominant architecture.
So we've asked this in the past, and I'm curious to get your point of view on this too, because a lot of times when you jump on a serverless technology or service, you tend to have vendor lock-in. Do you feel like we have, like you talked about a little bit of them in the past, IBM Cloud Functions, you have Lambda, you have Azure Functions, Google Functions. You know, once you're on these platforms, even though they say, hey, move your traditional type of application from that to like a more microservice architecture to more of just a infrastructure-less type thing. But now, even though once you're on there, you're kind of stuck. Is that true, or is it easier for people to move around?
It's a good question. I mean, the lock-in thing can be a bit of a scare tactic for any platform, right? Everything's lock-in. Using Java's lock-in. My marriage is lock-in. Like, everything has some sort of thing that has a switching cost, right? So when I'm thinking of switching costs, and so the function platforms themselves are not lock-in per se. It's just literally code. I could take that code and run it elsewhere. What becomes lock-in like is the fact of all the services you're tying together. So that's really unique service sitting in Amazon that does IoT or machine learning. That same thing isn't sitting in Google's cloud, or it's not sitting on premises or in IBM. So all of a sudden, that architecture isn't as portable. Now, maybe if I haven't written a ton of code and I've just tied together managed services, creating that elsewhere isn't as much work. as if I actually had to re-architect the whole thing. But it's probably going to be unusual to just lift and move one serverless architecture from one platform to another because of all those sticky hooks to all the managed services. Now, do people do it that often? Maybe not. Maybe this will be more for innovative things where lock-in isn't a huge concern. But it is something that is probably stickier than most of the other cloud services.
Right. Okay, so this kind of segues a little bit more into the ops side. Now, how does serverless add to the challenges for operations and DevOps perspective?
Well, you're assuming it adds to the challenges there. You're asking me a loaded question. I think, on one hand, it changes operations because, look, there's no more operating system patches. There's no more setting up infrastructure. There's no more open ticket. So the role of the operator does change. Right, I just don't have the same activities. Now, of course, there's always operations. There's still operations of my system. I still may have scale considerations for managed services. I still have to do access control for certain things. I'm still putting my apps on deployment pipelines. And what does that mean to actually deploy CI/CD application pipelines for a bunch of functions and a bunch of managed services? Like, that's a new challenge. It's a fun one, at least if you're in tech, but it is a different operational consideration for how do I keep this thing running online? How do I have visibility into what's going on? How do I audit later? How do I roll back? How do I do zero downtime deploys? So the operational considerations are different. They're still there, but I'm not dealing with maybe some of the more rote, mundane things like building and operating servers.
Now, for instance, how does this oscillate? You talked a little bit about how it may maybe even make operations a little easier. Now, does it make security easier? Does it make security harder?
It's a great question. I mean, on the security side, what's interesting is, again, potentially I'm writing less code, which means there's less opportunity for me to do bad things. That's cool. Now, I'm also potentially opening up new attack surfaces. With a lot of serverless applications, it's really easy to build a function that has a lot of cool dependencies on other libraries. Hey, I have to talk to a database. Hey, I'm going to do some other calculation. So my 25 lines of JavaScript could end up being 10,000 lines of actual code because of all the dependencies I've brought in. So now I have to think about how am I updating my code constantly because those dependencies can have vulnerabilities and be out of date. So security is a better story from my sense of I don't have to patch infrastructure. I'm not patching app servers. I'm not dealing with any of that. But I do still have to think about access control. I still think I have to think about fixing dependencies. I have to think about my network architecture and are things sitting in virtual private networks. Things, again, don't go away. Maybe just they shift a little bit in terms of the areas I'm focused on.
Makes sense. Now, there's a lot of services kind of encapsulated within Pivotal Cloud Foundry. One of them being this new service, which is based off of functions. Can you maybe take us through this new service and kind of how it fits into the current scheme of things?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Pivotal as a company, look, we have two pieces as we think about. We show companies the best way to build software, methodology, techniques, XP programming, and then we give you the best place to run that software, whether that's on-premises or the public cloud with Pivotal Cloud Foundry. And Pivotal Cloud Foundry is made up an application server, right? I'm just running application code, custom-built apps. I have Kubernetes service that's running containerized-based applications. And then we just added Pivotal Function Service saying, look, I'm going to want to have short-lived scale-to-zero compute that's very event-driven, doesn't need a full app server, doesn't need a full app experience. Instead, again, I want to build more data processing pipeline. I want to build network API listeners that are going to listen to network changes on premises because this can run on-prem or off. So the function service is on the Knative project, something we're co-developing with Google and a bunch of other companies to build this sort of open source multi-platform function runtime. So it's pretty exciting work. We're happy to be spending a lot of time on that. And then we're commercializing that Knative work into Pivotal Function Service.
Fantastic. Now, how is it? You say obviously there's lots of different services that are available. How does these all fit together? Is there what does your service provide to help these things fit together, and how do you manage them?
Yeah, when you think managed services that you stitch together, or the different site sort of phases. Make sure I answer right.
Yeah, I think the first one.
Yeah. So for all the different managed services, one thing we spend a lot of time on with Pivotal is building out that sort of ecosystem partnership network, so that look, I want to connect Cassandra databases to a Kafka bus. I want to connect MongoDB to this, or a mobile solution to this, or a native cloud service to something else. So that whole marketplace of services is available to developers. What I'm excited to see is us connect that to the function piece so that, again, I can do very event-driven things. This thing changes, spin up a function. whether that thing changing is an on-prem database, a cloud database, a message bus. So the more we can bring together those managed services into these function runtimes, the more developers are going to see the value here.
Fantastic, fantastic. Well, I do want to bring my co-host back in because they have some questions for you. I want to start with Curtis. Curtis, you have some security questions for our guest.
Well, being from dark reading, I know it's surprising that I think about security, but I'd like to poke just a little bit at part of what you said to Lou's earlier question about security. You know, with serverless, you have all of these APIs. You have all of these places where you have joints and unions between code. And as we know, every time there's one of those coding interfaces, there's going to be someone out there looking for a way to use it as a point of entry. Is there, or have you seen, a good either methodology or technology that says, you know, you can apply this and it will protect your entire serverless infrastructure?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, I haven't seen that specifically. Now, if you look at something like Amazon Lambda, which those functions aren't directly addressable, they have to sit behind an API gateway or something like that. So you also potentially get that cloud provider secure layer that's doing anti-denial of service stuff. They can have other things to try to make sure you're protecting that function. Other clouds do make things directly addressable. So again, to your point, all of a sudden you just have a different attack surface where this, even the same challenges like SQL injection can still pop somebody if they write the function the wrong way. So I haven't seen something that just parachutes over your serverless architecture and keeps you safe. I don't know if that sort of perimeter security is still an anti-pattern in the cloud, only because you have to think about each microservice in a modern architecture, not trusting any of its input outputs, right? I've got to think about each thing authenticated correctly, thinking about how it does its network traffic. Is it encryption at rest and in transit? How am I thinking about the whole architecture in pieces, not assuming I can protect the edge?
Well, I want to now turn slightly. I'll avoid saying pivot, given who you work for, to ask a different question around serverless. Out at RSA, one of the things that I heard a lot of people talking about was container-architected security, you know, using and people who were taking everything from firewalls to analytic systems from virtualization platforms to containers. Obviously, if you're taking things to containers, the next step along that pathway is going to be serverless. What do you think of a serverless architecture as a platform for security? Do you think it's the kind of application that lends itself to serverless, or are there reasons to kind of hang back on that?
Yeah, I don't think some of the appliances I would have had that, you know, if I have an appliance that's containerized by a vendor and drops into a Kubernetes cluster, that thing will never run in a FAS as is, right? Because those environments aren't set up that way. They're stateless, right? And a function as a service environment, these things today are short-lived. They're stateless. They don't have it. Those things are coming and spinning up based on events versus living there and having all of its rules stored, for example, if I were putting a firewall there. So, but I do think the future is going to be more managed services here. Right? If I look at every public cloud, it's security services, it's identity services, it's network services. None of these are really appliances that I manage. These are things with API endpoints, things that I connect together, these things I call with APIs. So I do think we're going to see more and more managed services for all of these sort of security functions, whether that's at the network, whether that's identity, whether that's encryption. And then in my functions, I'm able to connect and easily into those versus having to stand up infrastructure, manage those in containers or otherwise. That's really potentially undifferentiated work I want to get out of.
Fantastic. I want to turn over to Mo because she actually has some questions on data analytics.
Please.
Yeah, so I am going to use the word pivot. And actually, I'm going to jump right over the marriage analogy that you made, where I'm pretty sure you compared your wife to a platform, but we'll we'll bypass that one. One of the other big things that's the buzzword everywhere is this big data analytics concept. How is what you guys are doing, how does that affect data analytics, or how do you affect the ability to do data analytics?
Yeah, that's good. I think there's multi-pronged approach to that. I mean, one thing we're doing with, you know, one thing Pivotal does at scale is Greenplum, which is Postgres at petabyte scale. So it's multi parallel processing Postgres. So how do I actually do analytics with Postgres, massively parallel processing? And so we're actually putting that in containers. That's going to be supporting Kubernetes here. It actually is already. We'll be announcing that in a couple of days. And so even taking your data warehouse and putting that in a container runtime is an evolution in how I think about standing up environments, real-time spot analytics, those sorts of things. So there's sort of the analytics piece, and then there's the data loading. How am I thinking of more time analytics? And so we do work, we're the company behind Spring, the Java framework that's used by, it's downloaded 60 million times a month. It's a very popular Java framework. And even that has a lot of things for things like data processing. Spring Cloud Data Flow helps you model out data pipelines. And so I can do real-time data ingestion. I can do whatever I'm doing, data enrichment, or I'm doing quality checks on the pipeline before putting it somewhere. The point being, how am I processing data faster? How am I putting it into stores that I can analyze it easier? Is the idea nowadays, I think, of taking a batch file, loading it in, and getting some fresh analytics 3 weeks later, I think we're moving away from that. So I need easier access to this stuff. I need to empower developers to build pipelines versus expensive or proprietary kind of integration teams. And so I'm liking those trends. It's things that we're trying to help move forward, because the easier we can get these insights, the easier we're going to actually make our customers happy for people building software.
I do have one question in regards to, I know we have a lot of organizations out there that still are kind of moving into the digital transformation, they're moving into the digital age, and they still have, again, they move slowly by going on-premises service first, and then they kind of move into the greater cloud, sometimes private cloud, sometimes public cloud. So you have kind of these heterogeneous environments or these multi-cloud installations. How does, you know, how can they work with serverless, and potentially how can Pivotal help here?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, if multi-cloud is probably the norm, and not even just because customers can't make up their minds, it's because they've got significant multi-decade investments in what they already have. So even if they say tomorrow, we're all in on Amazon, congratulations. I mean, get ready for that decade-long journey, because you don't have the time, people, or budget to just lift and shift all your stuff. And if you do, you're probably not going to take advantage of the cloud in the first place, because running a server on premises, just a physical box, is always cheaper than just literally running the same thing in the cloud. But you use the cloud because you want agility, because you're trying to ship value faster. So for a lot of these companies, the idea is, I'm trying to go to the cloud to pick up speed. Can I potentially keep some of my skill sets the same? So can I layer a platform like Cloud Foundry or something similar that runs the same way on premises and in the cloud? So a lot of our customers are starting to even just use a straight up only on cloud and say, look, this is a better way to consume Azure. Azure is awesome. This makes Azure better. And it also has the exact same way of building and managing infrastructure as on-prem and deploying and managing apps as on-prem. And so when you start to do that stuff, your choice of cloud becomes maybe less important than actually shipping the software that your customers care about. And that's what I kind of get obsessed on, is the infrastructure stuff is fun and it's awesome for resume-driven development. But what matters the most, I think, is, are you building the software that your customers love using? And that should be awesome whether it's on-prem or in the cloud. We're trying to ship platforms that make it somewhat harmonious regardless of which ones you pick, and whether that's containers, functions, or apps.
Fantastic, fantastic. Well, unfortunately, we're running low on time. I do want to give you a chance, Richard, to maybe tell us where people can go to get started on Pivotal, where they can get to understand the new function services, and where they can just understand where they need to start.
Yeah, no doubt. Don't hesitate to go to pivotal.io to learn more about us. We just launched Intersect. It's pivotal.io/intersect. It's a CIO and kind of tech leader oriented site and newsletter. And then we do a number of events. Spring One Tour is where we're going to cities around the world, and Spring One Platform is our annual show where we have a lot of our customers on stage, from Kroger and Ford and the Home Depot and Comcast, the U.S. Air Force, telling their stories of how they've done complex changes and seen the positive results.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for being here. We definitely, serverless is a great topic. Plus, you talked a little bit about some of the things you're going to be coming out with in the near future. So we'll definitely have to have you back on to kind of talk about that stuff as well. So thanks so much for being here.
Hey, thanks, Lou. Thanks, team, for having me here.
Well, folks, you've done it again. You sat through another hour of the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe, according to 9 out of 10 FAS endpoints. But I want to thank everyone who does and makes the show possible, especially my co-host in crime, starting with Miss Heather Williams. Thanks again for being on the show, Mo. Can you tell the folks at home where they can find you and all of your work?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at Mo Better Wi-Fi. For the next 2 weeks, you'll be after Wednesday, you'll be able to find me in Singapore. So if anybody is Black Hat Asia bound, I am just thrilled to be able to bring you great Wi-Fi there. And stop by the Knock and say hey.
Fantastic. Thanks, Heather, for being here. Of course, we have to thank our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, where can the folks at home find you and all of your work?
Well, they won't be able to find me in Singapore because my great colleague Kelly Sheridan is heading in that direction to cover things. And Mo, if you get a chance, say hi to Kelly Sheridan. I think y'all get along really well. She's an amazing lady. As for me, I will continue to be writing and doing things at Dark Reading. You'll find my work there, and you'll find me pointing to them. Both from my Twitter feed at KG4GWA and my Instagram feed, Kurt_Franklin. I have a piece up this afternoon, that's Friday afternoon, on 7 low-cost cybersecurity tools, including things made with both Raspi and Arduino. I'd love to have you take a look at it. Let me know what you think about what I found, and let me know what I missed. I would love to build a much larger collection of good cybersecurity tools based on these teeny tiny little computers.
Thanks, Curtis. Well, folks, we also have to thank you as well. You're the person that drops in each and every week to watch and listen to our show and to get your enterprise goodness. And we want to make it easy for you to watch, listen, and catch up on your latest enterprise news. So go ahead right now to our show page, twit.tv/Twyatt. There you'll find all the amazing back episodes and the show notes, information about the co-hosts, our guests, and all the links to our stories. But more importantly, next to those videos there, you'll find those great helpful links to help you subscribe and download the latest versions and all of our versions of our show, both the audio version, video version, and HD video version. Listen on any one of your devices. Stay on top of your enterprise and IT news by listening or watching Twyatt. Now, after you subscribe, go ahead and share the show with your friends, your neighbors, your coworkers, whoever wants to listen and learn about tech news, especially enterprise tech news. We love watching this and doing this show, so we can continue to do it with your support. Now, after you subscribe, also remember we do the show live each and every week on Fridays at 1:30 p.m. Pacific, right here on live.twit.tv. Of course, if you're going to jump and watch the show live, you might as well jump into the chat room live as well at irc.twit.tv. Also, don't forget, you can follow me at twitter.com/LouMM. You can see what I do on my normally daily job by posting there. I post a bunch of stuff there each and every week, as well as you can check out dev.office.com. That's where we post our latest and greatest ways to customize Microsoft Office so to make your organization more productive. Now, I also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially thank you to Leo and Lisa, who continue to support us in doing this week in Enterprise Tech each and every week. Also, I want to thank all the engineers at Twit. Also, I want to thank Mr. Brian Chiebert. He's our tireless producer. He does all the bookings, the plannings for the show, and we really couldn't do the show without him. So thank you to him as well. Also, of course, we can't forget our TD for today. Alex, thank you so much, Alex, for all your work. Of course, we had to keep the tradition for today. What was the major topic of the show?
I believe it was about pivoting to the cloud.
Very, very close. That's that's not bad. That's mad. But I would say it's more about serverless eating the stack, but very close.
I just wanted to sound aspirational and put my to the cloud.
Maybe next time, Alex. Thank you, sir. And until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.